I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With a new episode every Macabre Monday, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers.
Spiritualism is the metaphysical belief that the world is made up of at least two fundamental substances, matter and spirit, or a soul, if you will. This very broad metaphysical distinction is used to explain the afterlife, spirits of the dead, deities, and mediums. I find, like magic, spiritualism works best on those who want to believe, but then there is the other side, those who want to know how. Science fiction author Arthur C. Clarke is known for the saying, "Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic." I feel like this, the last of Clarke's three laws, speaks to the history of spiritualism. This curious period where pseudoscience was invited to explain and give insight to people's religious beliefs. After the Civil War followed an age where disease and short life expectancies meant most people would suffer tragic losses. Now, everybody knows Harry Houdini for a couple of things. When the world-famous magician wasn't making headlines for escape acts, he was focused on debunking psychics and exposing mediums. His training in magic helped him to reveal the frauds who had successfully fooled scientists and academics. I'll talk a little bit about the standard of analysis back then. He was also a member of a scientific community that offered a cash prize to any medium who could successfully demonstrate supernatural abilities. None was able to do so, and the prize was never collected. He chronicled his debunking exploits in his book, A Magician Among the Spirits, co-authored by C.M. Eddy Jr. As he grew more famous, Houdini took to attending seances in disguise, accompanied by a reporter and a police officer, because fraud is still to this day illegal. These activities cost Houdini the friendship of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who, in addition to inventing Sherlock Holmes, was himself a physician. Doyle, a firm believer in spiritualism, refused to believe any of Houdini's exposés. Doyle came to believe that Houdini, despite all his debunking, was himself a powerful spiritualist medium and had performed many of his stunts by means of paranormal abilities and was using these abilities to block those of other mediums that he was debunking. This disagreement led to the two men becoming public antagonists and led Sir Arthur to view Houdini as a dangerous enemy. By 1897, spiritualism was said to have had more than 8 million followers in the United States and Europe, mostly drawn from middle and upper classes. There were traveling shows like the Bang Sisters, May and Lizzie, two spiritualist mediums from Chicago who made a career out of painting spirit portraits. Their mother was a medium herself and soon got her four children into that act. There were the Edie brothers, who were mediums who performed ectoplasm materializations, tricks with musical instruments, and communicating with spirit guides.
Which is really cool. That early ectoplasm photography and exposure to it in the early times, it was actually silks. A lot of times it was silks that were ingested and pulled out through a wire work or through a string work.
Oh my God.
It's amazing.
Wow,
it's
like the so like the handkerchief
cool.
trick
yeah.
that the clowns do, except it's coming from your gut.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh,
and
God.
So that's how they were doing some of it, because you'll see in those early ectoplasm photos too, you see it come from the nose and the mouth. I mean, it's just disgusting to imagine how it was done, but the effect is crazy great.
Yeah, the only I guess I haven't seen a lot of the photography of that. I mean, I've seen some, but like I'm just picturing the Haunting in Connecticut poster where the kid is like upwardly vomiting
yeah.
into the ether, some creepy thing. But to think that like that's probably based on a trick that was pulled back
yeah.
in the late 1800s.
It was really popular. There's actually quite a few photographs of it.
Yeah, it's funny. In this case, the Edie brothers were very easily debunked. Most of their tricks had to do with like just having someone behind a sheet playing an instrument or making noises or answering questions that way. Yeah, there was a seance box, which who knows what goes on inside the box. Like what I said before, as far as like the scientific standard for proof was pretty lax.
Yeah, pretty loose there. So you're talking, you know, about Houdini, and someone else to kind of watch at that point in time was also P.T. Barnum.
Yeah.
Ooh, he hated spiritualism.
Is he not the one who coined the term, there's a sucker born every minute?
Yeah. Okay. And it's like he is the enemy of spiritualism, which is really funny because you think it's a very like an American thing, the circus.
But and you'd think he'd appreciate the showmanship because that kind of is like 90% of the game.
Yeah, not so much there. But let's talk for a little bit. Let's unpack a little bit of that spirit photography idea.
Yeah.
This was really cool. Came about as an accident, as most things do. And a guy named William Mumler was the first person to do this. And he shot up into stardom doing these spirit photography sessions because Mary Todd Lincoln had received one of these. And what it is, because it was all the photography was done on glass plates, it's just a plate that wasn't cleaned well.
Yeah, so in essence, amounting to a double exposure.
Absolutely. And so that's what kind of rocketed this guy to stardom. And he was charging $10 a photograph, which is pretty crazy.
In those days, yeah.
Yeah. And so what he did with that is not just, yes, okay, fine. He kind of took advantage of people. Let's be serious. It's a fraudulent thing.
It is fraud,
thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he does. In the late 1880s, he actually does get tried for fraud. Mm. It doesn't end very well, right, for him in that way. But what he manages to do is actually change kind of the shape of Lincoln's public image. So I'm from Illinois, which is the land of Lincoln, and we have to take classes on Lincoln. And Lincoln is like next to Jesus Christ in Illinois. Okay, there's like Jesus, and then there's Lincoln. That's
he's a Republican.
Works.
I don't know if you know this, but not a lot of people know that.
I've heard that. I've heard that before. Whatever. But he in Illinois, he's always like this amazing God creature, and everyone loved Lincoln, and blah blah blah. That's just what you grew up believing. And then the more I started reading about Mary Todd Lincoln for this episode, Lincoln was not that popular. Even in the North, not a popular guy. Not well loved. And in the South, obviously, totally not loved.
Sure.
You know, I will say that the soldiers, the African-American soldiers who fought for the North were very much, you know, obviously Lincoln fans, which would obviously make sense. But as far as just the non-African-American population? No, not loving of Lincoln.
He doesn't sound, like by all descriptions, he was a depressed person. He was not like the life of the party at any point in his life. And
yes.
Then his marriage to Mary Todd Lincoln, who herself like was known to have like a short fuse. She had a bad temper.
Yeah.
She was easily set off. She was unpredictable. She was moody. She suffered from bad migraines.
Mm-hmm.
She had a head trauma when they were already living in the White House. They wiped out on a horse carriage. So
yeah.
Like we know head trauma can change a person's personality. In this case, like she already was known for likely having like bipolar disorder.
Yeah, I mean, we'll unpack that later.
Okay.
Don't you worry. We'll unpack some Mary Todd Lincoln because there's a lot of luggage to unpack about that. But when she went to see Mumler and the spirit photography really set off, it was after, obviously, you know, Lincoln had been assassinated. The Civil War was such a huge, fresh problem going on. And what it did, since people could not get the dead bodies out of the fields, a lot of bodies were left. And a lot of the Calvinist ideas for what happens to you after you die, if your body's just laying there and not being buried and not being blessed or anything like that, it's not good. So Americans had to rewrite this kind of their idea of their story of what happens if you can't collect the bodies.
Oh, boy.
It just made people feel better. So we had to rewrite kind of our idea on spiritualism. We had to rewrite our idea of superstition.
Okay.
Right? So we had to feel better as a country. And so spirit photography and Abraham Lincoln's specific spirit photography, he became like the Jesus poster that's in every grandma's house, you know, where he's like, it made people feel better to think that Lincoln was a father looking over his sons, looking over his families. Or for elderly people, he was like their son who had died in the war, and now he's in these pictures. So he became this father figure, and that's what shapes the Lincoln that we know today.
Yeah, and sort of serving as this cultural martyr.
absolutely. He became this big touchstone for humanity.
Is the, just to, so I'm clear on it, the sort of adaptation of Calvinism, was it to sort of further separate that idea of like the physical body, the matter, and the soul? And so that way, like, maybe it's not so important where your bones rest so long as your spirit gets to ascend.
Right. So it gives you an idea that you don't have to be blessed. We just needed something. The American people needed something because people were going into mass graves at that point in time. There was just nothing to be done. And I think there's this great idea, and Anne Douglas, she's a cultural historian. She calls it the domestication of death during the mid-1800s. And that's absolutely true. It became something because it was so familiar to everyone. It became something that we romanticized in a different way in America. And we did domesticate. It lived with us and we lived with it. And we had to have something culturally that made us feel better. So that's that idea. Yeah, we're separating the body from the soul. Doesn't matter what happens to the body because the soul's doing its own thing. And we had lots of people who liked that idea and perpetuated that idea of a ghost coming to see them or a ghost in their photography.
Sure. Yeah, it feels like every other person you meet has some story of like some unexplained, whether it's maybe a dream where they contacted a deceased one and had a conversation or like, you know, saw the face of someone somewhere. I personally have not had any of those experiences. Any unexplained anything? We kind of talked about it a little bit last time.
Oh, I've talked to my like great-grandparents in dreams before.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, I'm assuming that's not really them. I hope that they have better things to do.
Have you ever had perhaps even accidentally like moments of foresight that turned out to be right or intuition,
absolutely.
Unexplained intuition?
Absolutely. My mom is also very good at this.
Oh, yeah?
Like it's really, really crazy. And my mother-in-law, freaking get about it. If you do not want her to call, she will call you. Like the moment you're like, I hope not. And then you could have not thought about her the whole day whole like week or something. And then suddenly there she is on the phone. And you're like, I can't answer this phone right now. Like my husband and I are always like, oh my God, how
That's
is this
hilarious.
Possible?
Yeah. Which one of you invoked?
So you haven't. You never talked to people in dreams, anything like that?
No.
Really?
Yeah, nothing comes to mind.
And I'll tell you when I had probably one of those like just weird, weird things. When I had my really terrible car wreck and I was with I was driving, my friend was in the passenger seat. And so quickly, I know, and she knows what I said. And I said, I can't pull us out of this and we're going to wreck the car. Except for that all happened in the length of a second. There's no way that I said it, but both of us know exactly word for word what I said. And so there's things like that, you know, like how do you explain that?
Yeah. Yeah. That's like a psychic bond under trauma.
Maybe, right? Who knows how that works?
In a horror story, you would be compelled to replicate that scenario so you could feel that again and get a grasp on it. So you put yourself in ever increasingly dangerous scenarios.
Oh, wait, what's that movie?
I'm just saying that's a horror movie premise.
No, but it is White Noise 2.
That's the one with the Firefly guy. I don't remember that. I block most of that movie out of my head, except for the ending, because it's just kind of good. Everyone's dead.
This is where the temptations begin. Unlimited temptations.
Can I help you at all?
I'll tell you what, I'll give you 25 quid to get rid of it.
It's a deal.
Each concealing a horrendous nightmare that reaches out from the dark world that lies beyond the grave.
Come in. Whoever you are, come in.
Away! If you are looking for excitement, way beyond the normal.
No.
If you want to test your nerves beyond endurance, come beyond the mirror on the wall.
Feed me.
Spare Spiritualism hit a point where it was almost ubiquitous. Anybody felt like they could do it with a candle and dim lights and holding hands. A visual representation of that is the segment, The Gatecrasher, from the movie From Beyond the Grave from 1974. It's floating around the internet.
Yeah.
It's easy enough to find. Starring David Warner. Mostly he's the focus of the first segment. Mm-hmm. And Marcel Steiner is the face in the mirror. Also starring Peter Cushing, but he's not in the first section of the movie very much.
He's just in the very beginning.
Yeah.
Because this is a portmanteau film, so it's all tied together in this Needful Things kind of idea of this shop that everyone wants something from, and they have to pay Peter Cushing in trade.
Yeah, and David Warner thinks he pulled a fast one on Peter Cushing by accusing this antique mirror of being a fake, and it's only worth $25. So he essentially like robs him, but Peter Cushing knows better.
Yeah.
So like he's willing to get rid of that mirror, knowing it'll probably wind up right back in his shop.
Yeah, this is a more like a total like there's a lot of morality tales in just even this first one.
Yeah.
Number one, don't have a seance just for funsies.
I was puzzled by the quickness in which he's showing off his rare antique mirror and also admitting that he like just practically stole it.
Right.
I guess that the idea that it's creepy and it's old, the first thing that comes to people's mind is let's throw a seance.
Yeah, it happens twice in this short amount of time, because even at the end she's just like, this looks like a mirror that should be in a medium's parlor. And you're like, what? No, it looks like a mirror.
Right. Don't it wasn't stupid. A crystal ball. It was a mirror.
Oh, it gives me the shivers.
Why?
I don't know.
It looks like something that belongs in a medium's parlor.
Let's hold a seance.
What?
Let's hold a seance.
What a splendid idea. Get the stuff off the table and pull it into the middle of the room. It's seance time.
But you don't know anything about holding a seance.
My talents are limitless.
The seance does sort of bring to the front the spirit that inhabits it.
Right.
And I kind of love that idea that it took a seance. It's kind of the like ghost version of New Phone, who dis? Like it's I did like some of the language out of the ghosts. It reminded me of Little Shop of Horrors.
Yes.
When he's asking to be fed.
What do you want me to do? Slip my wrists?
Oh boy. Look, I got an idea. I'm gonna go down to Schmendrick's and pick you up some nice chopped sirloin.
Must be blood.
Tui, that's disgusting.
Must be fresh.
I don't want to hear this.
Beep, beep.
Does it have to be human?
Beep, beep.
Does it have to be mine?
Feed me!
Where am I supposed to
be? Because he only wants to eat blood. He's like, feed me blood.
Yeah, and David Warner gets progressively darker, and so I guess the mirror is not going to shut up or let him go until it gets it. So at that point, he's trapped.
Yeah, fine.
So, yeah, you asked for it.
Then he kind of commits suicide in this really bizarre, kind of overly drawn out way.
Yeah, I felt like they were probably padding. There's very little story in this first segment. So it does feel padded.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so I don't know. I just thought it kind of serves as a nice sort of look at what the mindset of a 1974 horror film, like, we'll just throw in seances and people will buy it. Mm-hmm. Why not? Everybody's doing it, right?
People were really into it.
I guess. So going back to the Lincolns and their relationship with spiritualists, Mary Todd and Abraham Lincoln lost their son William when he was 11 years old. Mm-hmm. They were already in the White House, and in this case, it was a long, painful bout of typhoid fever that took him.
Right.
Last week, we talked about Don't Look Now and The Changeling, two movies that relate to parents losing a child, but this really happened in the White House in 1850, just when the spiritualist movement was ramping up.
And they had previously lost a child before they even got into the White House.
Yeah, those are tough days.
Bad luck.
Yeah. Well, I guess it wasn't uncommon that, like, you would lose children, and mm-hmm. so it would kind of behooves you to have a lot.
A lot of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, Mary Todd Lincoln is interesting because, so they had this just terrible, terrible run of luck with their kids, but spiritualism in the White House actually starts before Lincoln. Oh. It starts with Franklin Pierce's wife named Jane Pierce. In 1852, she had lost her son in a really, really, they're in the White House at this point in time, but she lost her son in this like really violent, horrific train wreck.
Oh.
In front of her. Like,
oh, wow.
We're talking like major head trauma, which so Jane Pierce was there for it to see everything firsthand. And it created kind of this PTSD kind of situation with her. She, so distraught in 1852, she contacts the Fox sisters and actually has them.
Oh, really?
She has them over. So everyone blames, you know, like Mary Todd Lincoln. It's just that Mary Todd Lincoln was like out and proud about it.
Yeah.
And Jane Pierce is kind of like hiding, you know?
Wow. Okay.
So that's Jane Pierce. Then coming in, she kind of introduces Mary Todd Lincoln to this idea of not of spiritualism, but of allowing like, hey, yeah, you're in the White House, but we don't have to stop the seances just because you're here. Right. So wow. Mary Todd Lincoln actually hosts multiple seances while she's in the White House, and they host them in the Red Room. And they know that Lincoln went to at least one of them.
Yeah.
I think nowadays, especially people think of that spiritualist movement as just very gullible or maybe for uneducated people, something like that. Mary Todd Lincoln was actually really highly educated. She came from a really wealthy family, had a great education for a woman of that time that she could have. These weren't people who just fell off the turnip truck. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I remember reading that most spiritualists or fans of spiritualism were educated. They were, yeah. And we talked about it last time that like they had just enough education to make them dangerous. And in this case, like you kind of nod towards science and they're like, science sounds good to me. Like,
yeah. That's, it was a real thing. Even Thomas Edison was really fascinated with the idea of spiritualism.
Oh.
Even Scientific American would talk about certain spiritualistic things. I mean, it's not to say that it was just a bunch of dumb people being like, I love ghosts, 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 ghosts. You know what I'm saying? So Lincoln's assassinated. From that day on, Mary Todd Lincoln is only wearing black. And she was already into the spiritualist movement because of the death probably of her kids that led her into this. We also have just the zeitgeist at the time in American culture of believing spiritualism and wanting to believe in seeing our loved ones,
like, sure.
Again, is the idea. When I say that Mary Todd Lincoln gets a bad rap, I really mean it. She does, because people think of her as crazy. And yeah, she had quite a temper.
She was eventually forcefully institutionalized.
She was forcefully institutionalized later on in her life, but she was also let out on her own reconnaissance later, right?
Oh.
So there's this great film, if you can find it, it might be on the internet. It's called The Insanity Retrial of Mary Todd Lincoln.
Wow.
And it was redone, the trial, with the facts that we know now, using actual facts and not politics. At the time Mary Todd Lincoln was on trial, was really aggressive, very aggressive politics at that time. And it became a political war, not really a war on Mary Todd Lincoln. Her son was the one who kind of said, I want to institutionalize her. Maybe he didn't really honestly have her best interests at heart. Maybe they didn't like that she was using all the government's money because she was awarded a stipend.
Sure.
She had to live and her husband died for the country. She should be entitled to something. Maybe they didn't really like how she was spending that.
It feels like everything she did had a taint on it after a certain point. Yeah, she was sort of publicly humiliated.
Right. So if you find this, The Insanity Retrial of Mary Todd Lincoln, this video, it's a real judge with real lawyers, current modern-day judge, modern-day lawyers, and reenactors portraying Mary Todd Lincoln from things we know from her diary, accounts from the actual trial, things like that. And they actually retry the case with a jury. Everything. And they film it. And it's very cool. It's like one of the weirdest things I stumbled upon. And I was like, this is so cool. So while Mary Todd was getting the spirit photography done, having seances, things like that, after Lincoln is assassinated, politically, spiritualism becomes very important in American culture. Because now Abraham Lincoln is telling people what to think from beyond the grave. So you'd have these seances where Lincoln would show up. And I had told you before, you know, he was this fatherly now figure as a ghost. So he would have great advice on what to do about your crops. He would have great advice on financial issues. But he would also tell you who to vote for.
People were invoking Abraham Lincoln as a spirit guide.
Yeah.
Wow.
Not just Abraham Lincoln. Lots of elder statesmen that had passed away. it was really rampantly crazy popular. The only dead statesman that really wasn't being invoked here was George Washington. Everyone else was fair game, and they...
Well, he could not tell a lie.
Well, see, maybe that's why.
Yeah. So you've got two different pieces of, like, cultural cliche clashing at this point.
Honestly.
We don't dare bring back George Washington. No. God forbid what he might say to us.
Exactly.
Like in Penny Dreadful, he's going to start confessing our sins. He's going to start embarrassing us.
We don't need the mirror turned on us, Mr. Washington. Thank you. Yeah, no, it became a really big problem, and I think that's what kind of... started to lead this idea that spiritualism was hand in hand with being naive or being stupid, because it got to be stupid because people were making it stupid.
Yeah.
And you had to expose. And I think people like P.T. Barnum and especially Houdini, I think that's what more pissed them off than anything. It's the idea that Abraham Lincoln is telling me how to vote, and that's dangerous, and that's sure. a huge problem.
And it's also the people who are... presenting that as like something you could buy into. You just, yeah. you know, pay me a couple of bucks. I'll gather your friends. I'll show up and hold a seance and
yeah.
we'll see what the dead presidents have to say about your life.
It was a real problem.
It's a pretty gross fraud. Last week, we talked about the comfort that people can take in those moments. And frankly, it serves as like an impromptu therapy session, but like, therapy kind of gives you like coping mechanisms and sort of
right.
prepares, like emotionally prepares you for living beyond this, and doesn't put it on this singular crutch of this dead one is happy and so you should be happy.
Right. It is a dangerous thing, and you just have to think about the urbanization of America at that time. You have to think about certain social things and why it became so popular. I mean, I think always, you know, I had known about it. Spiritualism in America, but I never understood where it came from until I started really digging in and reading some of this stuff. But you can understand how it became so popular. I mean, this is one of them, that there was a clear reason and there was a clear gateway to this becoming such a popular thing.
One of my favorite episodes of Penny Dreadful was only the second episode in, titled Seance. This time around directed by the brilliant J.A. Bayona of The Orphanage fame and When a Monster Calls. It's a nice demonstration of the context of, like I said, like educated people, well-to-do, holding a seance because it's kind of like a party trick.
Yeah.
And they've invited the medium, Madame Colley, who, a.k.a. Evelyn Poole, who we later reveal is a much more important part of the story. But when the seance begins, and Vanessa Ives is accompanying Timothy Dalton, whose name escapes me at the moment, but when the seance begins, it's, you know, it's all the sort of standard things as far as holding hands, dim the lights. Dimming the lights is always important. I appreciate that.
Yeah, you gotta be a little leery of dimming the lights to make the ghosts come out, right?
Is there something against spirits working in the light?
Pat, spirits take strength from the dark. Perhaps that's the natural law of their world.
Vanessa Ives, up to this point, like we know there's something more to her character. She is a devout Christian. She prays with fury.
Right.
But that's kind of all we've seen so far of her character. But then when it turns out that like she is the legit medium, being witness to this, you know, this act of spiritualism kind of drags her into this, you know, portal, if you will, this sort of channeled conversation that's happening. And so it's this great dynamic where the medium who they've paid, Madame Colley, is at the center of this thing, but all of a sudden Vanessa Ives, like, gains the spirit.
Yeah.
Summon it. Serpent hidden one. Know your master, your lover, your master.
Father
mine,
Let me come with you. What a ripping time we'll have. Let me come with you. It'll be an adventure. You'll teach me. I'll prove myself a proper explorer. Peter loves you, Father.
And it gets really dark when she, like, turns her eye to the crowd.
Yeah.
Vanessa saw that. Fucking animal. You animal. Betrayer. Creature. I look into his eyes and they are red with blood like from Peter's arse.
Yeah, she, like, really reads Timothy Dalton's character, and it is not nice. So we have 1853's Spirit Rappings, composed by W.W. Rossington. This song became a sort of anthem to the spiritualist movement, something people still do covers on YouTube. It's actually not an obscure kind of piece of music, even though I'd never heard it before. But here you go, on the piano, W.W. Rossington's Spirit Rappings.
In terms of appealing to the public and, well, frankly, having something to sell them to take advantage of the spiritualist movement, we enter the talking board, or it's more commonly known these days as the Ouija board. But right. It's kind of like Band-Aid in terms of, like, adhesive strip.
Right, that's a brand.
Being the product, Band-Aid is the brand. So Ouija is the brand. The talking board long precedes it.
Mm-hmm.
The board, as we know it today, dates back to 1890. A Baltimore businessman, Charles Kennard, gathered a group of investors to capitalize on their talking board, which was born out of the spiritualist movement and introduced to the wider world 4 years earlier. But the Kennard Novelty Company had no name for its wooden board, inscribed with letters, numbers, and the words yes and no. Mm-hmm. It would later be expanded to offer a number of, like, varied things. They were just looking for, like, you know, an expansion of the product by changing
sure.
a couple things. Like, you gotta have the newest version. It's like a
2.0.
It's like an operating upgrade, yeah. So on April 25th, 1890, Kennard was hanging out with fellow investor Elijah Bond and Bond's sister-in-law, Helen Peters, who was known as a strong medium. Mm. And they decided, like, well, not unlike the From Beyond the Grave, we got a curiosity amongst us. Let's have a seance and figure this out. So we'll ask the spirits what we should name our talking board.
Oh, this sounds very kind of.
It does. The group waited with their fingers resting on the paddle-shaped planchette and watched the board spell out O-U-I-J-A in response to their query. When the group asked what Ouija meant, the board answered, good luck.
Oh.
And that was the last thing it communicated back. Ouija doesn't mean good luck. I mean, it's kind of...
Doesn't mean anything.
I mean, right. It's kind of, I mean, it's like an assembly of two yeses. It's kind of like the French
oui and yeah.
But all right, that's all I got. However, there was something Peters wanted to share. According to Kennard, she drew a chain from her neck and showed the men a locket with an image of a woman and the word Ouija written below. Kennard asked Peters if she had been thinking of the locket during their session, and Peters said no. That was enough for Kennard. And the board had found its name.
No, I didn't do that. I didn't think of that.
Like, that is the level of scientific scrutiny. It's like, did you do this on purpose? No.
No.
Good enough for me. Let's
Were
pack up and let's get out of here.
This? No.
It's the worst version of the Kevin Spacey in Usual Suspects looking at the board and assembling a story. It's like, oh, I thought of a thing and I said the thing. And
exactly.
Then I said, good luck.
Good luck. Well, like, I don't understand why certain, good luck, why is that on there? Goodbye, those things, like, why? Because, you know, it's bad luck if you don't say goodbye.
You got to close it out, yeah. We even, in our EVP episode, we made sure to, like, say goodbye, don't follow us home.
I mean, we got to stick to the rules, you know, it is the rules. I remember one time in college, my friends and I made a Ouija board out of a pizza lid and a shot glass. And because I went to college in, like, one of the most haunted cities in Illinois, and so we thought something good would happen, but we just drank a lot. I don't even remember the rest of the evening, honestly. I don't remember what happened. happened. I don't think any ghosts came. I think I would have remembered that.
In a group of drunk people, it's probably going to be tricky to like get a consensus of like even just like movement on the board. I think in the last episode I mentioned that I've only done the Ouija board once, and it was in San Francisco when I was going to art school. We went to a cemetery on, it was either Devil's Night, like late at night, or Halloween. I can't remember exactly, but it was around that time.
Okay.
And I guess I just wanted to get it over with. I don't think anybody was coming forward, but I volunteered, and my friend Kim also, and then Carl and Pete were going to watch us do the thing and sort of read out the letters that it
Oh, because you guys were going to keep your eyes closed.
Because we had our eyes closed. Uh-huh. And I couldn't tell you what. I wasn't really buying into it. Kim was crying. Kim was wow. really upset that when the planchette started to move and Pete and Carl couldn't agree on what to have it say. So they're trying to like, you know, I sync up themselves silently figuring out right. like how what message they're going to communicate with. Kim's losing her mind and I'm losing my patience. And it eventually, I don't even remember what they got it to say, but it was some like very basic stuff in response
to or something.
Yeah, no. So it was a bummer. They do say that when they took their hands off of it, it moved a nudge. Yeah. As things do. I wasn't witness to that. I didn't buy it. Right. I thought it was very silly. Yeah, that's my only Ouija experience.
Fair enough. Yeah, I don't think I would mess with it now because, number one, someone's going to cheat. Everyone's a cheater.
It's very loosely studied. There's a big wonder that this research doesn't really find funding. But there is supposedly a reason to use a Ouija board to make contact with one's subconscious.
Okay.
I mean, that's, it's so silly.
It's like that writing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in that way, it's supposed to be accessing information that you are relaying without realizing you're relaying it.
Okay.
Except it sounds like hokum to me. Yeah. So not any actual use for a Ouija board except for fun and games. And movie premises.
Yeah, just movie premises. It's interesting because the idea comes from like water divining and divining.
Does it?
Yeah, and that's where the idea of the planchette and like going towards something.
Yeah.
It's the idea of divining and that's an interesting idea because divining could be in some really deep down way factual in that water or quartz or certain things have certain vibrations.
Okay.
And so divining would make sense if maybe you're in touch with
if you had like a tuning fork, if you will.
Something like
that's
that.
That's calibrated to that.
Yeah, you might feel like maybe a tiny pull or something. You know what I'm saying? But that's the idea. That's where the Ouija board, the idea of getting these letters and everything, it's from divining.
So the next movie we're going to talk about, before we talk about that and how I've come around to liking it, I will tell you why I have come around on the movie Red Lights.
Yeah.
And oddly, it was because of a documentary that I saw before rewatching it. The documentary is the 2004 An Honest Liar.
Gentlemen, I'm the Amazing Randy.
The Amazing Randy.
The Amazing Randy.
Ta-da!
A conjurer, prestidigitator, liar, cheat, and fake.
The life of Harry Houdini reads very similar to the life of James Randi.
If you're going to get your head cut off, you go to the best guy. Amazing Randi was the best guy.
Randi, you've been going around the country trying to debunk those who say that it's psychic power.
I can't think of that technical term. Oh, yes, bullshit.
What I do is bending or breaking objects.
Uri Geller pulled the pants off them. It was astonishing.
Bend. Look.
Can you do the spoon bending trick?
Does Dolly Parton sleep on her back?
Do you know how many times Randy tried to ruin my career?
You've been taking a lot of medication.
Peter Popoff is a very dangerous man.
In the name of Jesus!
Popoff just seemed to be able to hear the voice of God and know all about people.
John, 3784.
We wondered how he got the information.
I dressed as a security guard.
I appeared in disguise.
Yeah. Randy is trying to say this is a big hoax.
Duh. I'll take 2 8 by 10.
That man that puts the fear of God into all those psychics. The Amazing Randy!
Directed by Tyler Meesom and Justin Weinstein, it follows the Amazing Randy. From a young age, he idolized Houdini. He became an incredible escape artist on his own. And he also followed Houdini's footsteps in terms of his strong feelings about spiritualists and psychic mediums and people who he saw as outright frauds, people who were pulling a hoax.
Now, these people need to be stopped. Seriously, now. They need to be stopped because this is a cruel farce. We get people coming to the foundation all the time. They're ruined financially and emotionally because they've given their money and their faith to these people.
James Randi, the Amazing Randi, established a similar scientific, we'll call it a scholarship or a prize,
right,
for someone who could actually perform, you know, a trick, a magic act under the scrutiny of like scientific analysis. So back in the day, the Fox sisters had someone like disrobe and make sure they didn't have, you know, like any sort of gadgets or anything that they were doing. And they would look under the table, but no one noticed that they were snapping their toes like
the
people snap their fingers.
Shoes.
Yeah. So, you know, between that and like the Ouija board, scientific scrutiny back then wasn't much. But in the modern era, James Randi is noticing simple things like guys like Uri Geller would tap or shift a table that had a number, like essentially doing the shell game, guessing where this particular ball was. And so the ball with weight would change the way something moves when a surface is jostled. And he would just, you know, do it a couple times and pick it out. And that's, you know, you do it subtle enough and you sort of distract people. It looks like, wow, he intuned. How did he know that that ball was in that cup? So James Randi goes, you know, put a little bit of sticky something on each of the cups and they won't shake when he moves the table and he's not going to be able to do it. And on Johnny Carson, that happened.
Like, oh, man.
He debunked him on television. So that guy became a little obsessive. He's a funny guy, and these days he looks a lot like Gandalf the White. He's a bearded guy. He's kind of hunched over, and he's a fascinating human being. But his commitment to debunking and sort of truth is, you know, made him an unlikable figure in certain circles.
Right.
But I really dug the documentary. It goes to some curious places, but overall, like, I found it fascinating. Even made more so because it is kind of dramatized in the movie Red Lights.
Yeah.
Dr. Matheson, you can't imagine how pleased I am to see you.
This is Dr. Matheson, actually.
That's Dr. Buckley.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Nice to meet you.
There are two kinds of people out there with a special gift. The ones who really think they have some kind of power. And the other guys who think we can't figure them out.
No, Leo.
Correct your position to your right. Richard Vargas.
I'm calling Richard Vargas in the name of God.
They're both wrong.
So have you been working for Matheson long? Or are you a psychologist too, or a magician?
Actually, I'm a physicist.
So why do you do this?
Do what?
Investigate fake paranormal stuff.
Simon Silva, perhaps the most celebrated psychic of all time, will visit us here in just under 3 weeks. There will be a mad rush for tickets.
Are there no real challenges left out there?
Silver's a real challenge.
Silver's already been investigated.
Yeah, like 30 years ago. We should investigate him now.
Written and directed by Rodrigo Cortez and starring my favorite, Cillian Murphy. You can't go wrong. I don't know why you never liked this movie to begin with, because it's freaking amazing. Anyway, also Sigourney Weaver is in it. Robert De Niro is in it. He's not mugging to the camera. He's actually doing a really great job.
He is. Yeah.
I love Sigourney Weaver.
You know what? That De Niro is wearing glasses for most, if not all, of the movie. I think it kind of forced him to not rely on just like
the
De Niro
mugging
tricks. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I thought it was acted amazing. Toby Jones shows up at one point in time, and I love him in it. He's like really great. And the idea is that Cillian Murphy works with Sigourney Weaver, and they are trying to debunk these spiritualists, these mentalists all over the world.
Yeah, they're like professor and assistant mm-hmm. at a school. I don't remember exactly what their department is, although it's woefully underfunded. We do find that out.
I wish I could work in that department. That would be so cool. Oh, my God.
Have you ever come across a single case that couldn't be explained, like the existence of an anomalous ability?
An anomalous ability? Like what? Like running 100 meters in under 10 seconds? Like composing a masterpiece when you're stone deaf? Your brain may be the exception, Ben, but most brains carry out a dazzling array of complex mental processes every second. 100,000 million neurons in constant synaptic communication geared to generating and regulating our sensations and perceptions. How we reason, how we think, our emotions, our mental images, our attention span, learning, memory. Are these not merits enough for the brain without it having special powers as well?
So you're saying the existence of any kind of paranormal powers is impossible?
What I'm saying, Miss Owen, is that after 30 years of investigating all kinds of phenomena with the right controls in place, I have yet to witness a single miracle.
And Robert De Niro comes in because he is Simon Silver, and he is the leading, most famous mentalist psychic guy around.
Simon Silver became incredibly popular at the end of the 60s, and his fame continued to grow over the next decade. In 1975, he suddenly announced his retirement, stunning his legion of fans. Many linked his exit from the limelight with the death of a veteran journalist, Martin Weiner, a skeptical reporter who suffered a rare kind of heart attack while attending one of Silver's shows. The post-mortem concluded the heart attack was the result of natural causes, but Silver was never quite able to shake off the suspicion surrounding Weiner's death. He disappeared just as suddenly as he had become a star, which is why his comeback announcement more than 30 years after his last public appearance.
Yeah, he's kind of an amalgamation of different mentalists and psychic healers and Uri Geller, who I mentioned for bending the spoons. So he's kind of like, he's supposed to be the best of them.
Mm-hmm. So Sigourney Weaver and Cillian Murphy, they debunk a lot of people, but they're big, big fish is Robert De Niro, and he's going to have this huge show.
It's the white whale.
And they cannot ever get him. She tried before multiple times. They have a history, Robert De Niro and Sigourney Weaver.
He's also like sort of counterattacking at times, but it, you know, in the way like nothing can trace back to him.
Mm-hmm.
So it does lend for like these creepy, these eerie moments where these two investigators are like seemingly haunted in their own right.
Yeah. I think one of the things that I like the most about this is the relationship between Sigourney Weaver and Cillian Murphy.
Yeah.
In that Cillian Murphy, his character in this, it always has this edge of wanting to believe. So while both of them are debunking, but there's also this want that maybe this one's for real.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And so you feel that way, I think, during the whole movie, is maybe this one's for real. Then they debunk it. Some of them are easy for them to get.
Yeah.
Some of the ones in the very beginning. But then you want it to be real. And I think Cillian Murphy and Sigourney Weaver on some level also want it to be real.
Yeah, well, she's impressive because, without giving spoilers, like, she is someone who has suffered loss. And in the same way of, like, the origins of the spiritualist movement, She's got reason to want mm-hmm. to believe.
I think everyone wants to believe.
The movie was both written and directed by Rodrigo Cortez. He popped up. I guess we never covered it in the show. We've alluded to it, but the movie Buried mm-hmm. with Ryan Reynolds is like a brilliant bare bones story. Ryan Reynolds, I mean, if
that
anyone's seen the trailer,
is so good.
He is buried. He is in a coffin. It is not like a decorative style coffin. It's a box.
Yep.
And he's got a cell phone and he's got a signal. We'll kind of overlook that. I don't know how deep a signal will go. But in any case,
that's part of the sad part of it.
Having to negotiate his own life with people who have taken him hostage. Mm-hmm. And he's overseas. He's in, I don't remember where in the Middle East specifically, but he's a independent contractor who's just driving a truck. And it all went bad, and now he's got to get in touch with the insurance companies who kind of pay out for hostage situations. And also make amends to like any loose ends he has in his life because it's this like
there's
wildly
a lot
dramatic,
going on with one man in a hole in the ground.
And so Rodrigo Cortez makes really good use of basic premises in this case. I do like the spiraling of Cillian Murphy and when he becomes obsessed, when he sort of inherits this white whale and has to take it upon himself to disprove or figure out what's going on. I think when I originally saw the movie, I found it a little too simplistic, but I will say I really dug into the parallels between the James Randi story and this, because when they debunk things, that is directly out of James Randi's catalog.
I am a mentalist. I got a mind like you. I'm a clairvoyant because I can see clearly.
He hasn't changed a single word.
The only difference.
You know Palladino from before?
Well, not exactly. We've had Leonardo Borga, Giordano, and who is it?
Zurica.
Zurica, but Leonardo Palladino, it's our first time.
And we're just thrilled.
And he can't see us?
No, not with this light. The glass is polarized. No one can see anything.
Unless, of course, they have special powers.
I'll tell you what I don't believe.
Watch this.
I don't believe in angels of light here in the good. I don't believe in extraterrestrial beings coming down from the sky to guide the human race to an age of awakening.
That's new.
I don't believe in spirit.
In this case, they just have to find the right frequency on which the booth is talking to the performer. And that James Randi did that very specifically and affected the way like televangelist type faith healers would operate from then on. And so when that appears in the movie, I was just kind of like, I was thrilled. I was kind of like, well, hell, this is based on a real thing. That makes it so much
then
more interesting to me.
Yeah. I don't know. I think the acting is just so good. I mean, that is something. Cortez gets some really great performances. This time he has a, like a trio of really solid actors.
Yeah, I'll watch Sigourney Weaver read the phone book.
Yeah, I mean, and so that's excellent. But like, The performance he gets out of Ryan Reynolds, that's not Van Wilder. He is like an entirely different person. And,
underrated dramatic actor.
Totally underrated. Yeah. He's so good in Buried. And this, I mean, you can't ask for better acting. There's one person who stands out as a little bit less, but that person disappears halfway through the movie and you forget that character even exists.
Cortez made a judgment call.
Yeah, like, oh, she's on vacation.
So that'll close us out on this second look at spiritualism and seance culture. And we're in all the usual social media places. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, @ Rance Macabre. Our email is therancemacabre@gmail.com. Drop us a line. I'm going to speed through this other stuff. We're on Patreon. Get all of our extra bonus content, episodes, music, skits, all that stuff is waiting for you on Patreon for $1 a month. You could join the party. What else?
We have our website, therancemacabre.com. You can donate, but you can also check out extra stuff on there too.
Yeah, you can stream all our episodes directly from it. And you can also do a search if you're curious what movies we've covered or you can find it there.
Yeah.
This is me, Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.
Macabre, cutting,
culture,
and curated.